This Is Actually Happening features real experiences that often include traumatic events. Please consult the show notes for specific content warnings on each episode and for more information about support services. For the past month, we've been diving deep into the stories of four survivors of the tragedies of September 11th, 2001, whose jobs brought them face to face with the unthinkable in a series we've been calling The Long Shadow. Today, we present the fourth and final story in the Long Shadow series, featuring Sandeep Jahar, a cardiologist who volunteered at a temporary morgue to help process the remains. As added bonus content for the series, we're releasing an interview between me and Dan Taberski. Dan is the host of the podcasts Missing Richard Simmons, Running from Cops, and most recently, The Line. His new show is called 9/12, and the series is about what happened after 9/11, how 9/11 the day became 9/11 the idea, and how that idea has shaped the world, our culture, and ourselves for the past 20 years. Dan and I had a great conversation about our two very different but complementary series about 9/11, what that day meant to both of us, what the experience means now 20 years later, and what we've learned from creating our respective series on the subject. If you are a Wondery Plus subscriber, you can check out that bonus interview today, as well as other bonus content for the series. However, we're also making that interview available on the free public feed for everyone this coming Wednesday. So if you have Wondery Plus, check it out now. If not, look for that interview coming up in a couple days. After wrapping up the Long Shadow series today, we will resume with our regular weekly This Is Actually Happening episodes starting next week. It's been an honor sharing these stories of September 11th with you all, and amazing to see the outpouring of love and support from listeners. Thank you all for sharing your own thoughts and experiences, and for your ongoing and continued support for what we do.
The surrealism of the experience it was hard to fathom. Like, I thought I was in a movie. This had to be some sort of setup. And here we were, you know, in a clothing store, being asked to do these sort of impossible thing.
From Wondery, I'm Whit Misseldine. You're listening to This Is Actually Happening, with our special series honoring the 20th anniversary of 9/11, The Long Shadow. Episode 205, The Long Shadow, Part 4. What if you processed the remains? This Is Actually Happening is sponsored by Airbnb. I travel often, and when I'm away, my home never sits empty. I've been an Airbnb host for over 10 years, and it's always been the perfect way to make a little extra money to help supplement my travels while I'm gone. You can even plan around events, like maybe there's a big tournament coming to town and lots of fans will be visiting. You could Airbnb your home or extra room and make some extra money. Your home or spare room might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. Audible is the home of storytelling. In addition to an incredible selection of audiobooks, you'll discover thousands of podcasts from popular favorites to exclusive Audible originals from top celebrities, renowned experts, and exciting new voices in audio. Currently, I'm listening to Killers of the Flower Moon by David Gran after seeing the film and wanting to know more about the story. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/happening or text happening to 500-500. That's audible.com/happening or text happening to 500-500. This Is Actually Happening is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
I was born in India in 1968. My father was a research geneticist in India. He was very ambitious. And when I was 3 years old, we moved to Wales. My brother and I and my mother and my father. He was a plant geneticist and did really some seminal work in wheat genetics as well as in the genetics of certain grasses, and that got him quite a bit of scientific fame. Because of what my father perceived to be sort of racial prejudice against him, and he didn't get a sort of permanent position in Wales, and despite having done really good work, his tenure ended, and we moved back to India in 1975, which happened to be a very turbulent time in Indian politics. Indira Gandhi was prime minister, and because of what she and her governing party perceived to be kind of rogue elements in the government and in Indian society that were undermining the government and the country. And so politicians and academics were rounded up and put in jail, and there was curbs put on freedom of press. And in that kind of environment, my father decided that we needed to leave India permanently and emigrate to the United States. My father was one of the first scientists to work on what was called the Green Revolution in India and South Asia. I mean, it was a program of scientific research to essentially produce high-yield crops to help feed the poor. And he really wanted to continue his work in the Green Revolution, but the resources just weren't there for him to do what he felt he needed to do. So he applied for emigration papers, and you know, back then, it was relatively easier, and actually got it in 6 weeks, which is, you know, today almost unbelievable. He immigrated under the status of scientists of exceptional ability. We emigrated and we moved to Kentucky in a snowstorm, January 7th, 1977. And we lived in Kentucky for 2 years until my father decided to move us to California. And this was kind of a sort of theme of my early childhood. It's kind of a peripatetic existence, because my father and other academics, especially from foreign countries, had a very hard time getting permanent sort of academic positions in the U.S. So my father's experience of scientific research and the difficulties led him to push his two sons into medicine. He wanted us to avoid the struggles that he had experienced doing science. My brother took that up and embraced it with gusto. He sort of always knew he wanted to become a doctor. I, on the other hand, had many other interests, you know, politics and philosophy and writing. I was very interested in writing. My mother and my father were very different. My mother was essentially a homemaker. She had grown up in affluence. He had grown up in relative poverty. But they both agreed that medicine was the way for their children in this new country. They encountered a lot of racial prejudice and a lot of instability, and that was all, you know, even more difficult to handle in financial struggle. And so the way my mother perceived it, going into medicine was a chance to do well by doing good. That was the way to break out of the limitations that they had encountered. It was complicated for me because my family history was one that had a lot of heart disease. My father's father died of a heart attack when he was in his early 50s. He died actually suddenly in the presence of my father. They were having lunch together and he collapsed and died. And that experience really traumatized my father and by extension me. I sort of grew up with this fear of the heart as the executioner of men in their prime. And so I would always worry, you know, what was going to happen to my father? I had this sort of malignant family history, and my other grandfather eventually also died of a heart attack. And I was drawn to medicine because of that family history, but then I was also drawn to what I considered more creative pursuits. So I told my father I was not going to become a doctor. So I ended up going to Berkeley and I decided to study physics. I became fascinated with it when I went to Berkeley, you know, how things worked, how the universe worked. And that gives you a little bit of an idea of the kind of warped culture in which I grew up, where rebellion is saying no to a career in medicine and then going into experimental physics. But I do remember my father kind of pressing and saying, you're making a mistake. And there was truth to that worry, because when I eventually graduated from my physics training, there just were no jobs. It was very hard. I decided to stay at Berkeley and pursue a PhD. It was while I was pursuing my physics research that I started to have second thoughts. Someone who was very close to me, my girlfriend, was diagnosed with a disease called lupus. I had never heard of lupus. She told me that there was no cure and really no effective treatment. That just totally floored me. That kind of launched me on this journey to learn more about this condition. And in the course of it, I went to medical libraries, I went to support groups, I spoke to decorated researchers, and I came to appreciate that what was lacking in my own academic pursuits was people. I was working on a very esoteric semiconductor structure called a quantum dot. And it was very interesting, but I knew that quantum dots weren't going to help people. So I really wanted to join up with what I perceived as the real world, the world outside of the university. Part of it was going to support group meetings and seeing how patients and their family members were transfixed by what the doctors were saying. I mean, the doctors had knowledge that was so highly relevant to the lives of these people. I started to question, you know, what am I doing? You know, what am I going to do to really make a difference? At the same time, my brother, who I told you had always embraced the idea of becoming a doctor, he was already a doctor by then. Residency is a very difficult time, but he loved it. They just had a sense of purpose. In comparison, what I was doing just seemed selfish. It was right around then that I decided that I was going to start taking pre-med classes. I was in my mid-20s, and I started taking freshman biology. I ended up finishing up my PhD, so I do have a PhD in physics, got in to Washington University in St. Louis, and so I started there after my PhD in the fall of 1995. I made it through the first 2 years, and then got to the hospital my third year. And that's where I really was happiest, when I was actually dealing with patients. And when I was in the hospital, I just felt like I had made the right choice. So I graduated from WashU in 1998 and went to New York and started my internship at New York Hospital. Spent 3 years there. The mid portion of my second year, I decided that I was going to specialize in cardiology. I grew up with this fear of the heart as an executioner. You know, when I was growing up, I used to think about my heartbeat. I used to feel it. I would lie in bed and time my heartbeat with the revolutions of the ceiling fan. You know, I was just interested in this thing in my body that is always beating, that beats so many millions of times in the course of a human lifetime. That's so powerful that it can push blood through literally miles and miles of blood vessels in the body. So for a lot of different reasons, I decided that I wanted to apply for a cardiology fellowship. And fortunately, I got the fellowship at NYU. During the first year, which was 2001, that first summer from July to September, we got basic training. So I was still kind of relatively green by the time 9/11 rolled around. Thank you.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery. Late nights at work taking a toll on your skin? Do you find yourself staring at those dark circles in the mirror? Well, it's time to meet your new best friend, Dark Circle Defense Balm from Lumen. Lumen is a line of brilliant men's skincare solutions crafted especially for men who want to look and feel their brightest. Whether you're a seasoned skincare pro or a total newbie, Lumen Skin has got you covered. Lumen's Dark Circle Defense Balm is a lightweight gel that absorbs seamlessly into your skin to brighten your under eyes and instantly plump dehydration lines. It's basically an espresso shot for your eyes. The best part? Lumen will let listeners of this podcast try the product out for free. Yes, you heard that right. Free. Head to lumenskin.com/Wondery and get your free trial of Dark Circle Defense and their other amazing products now. Say goodbye to tired-looking eyes and say hello to a new and refreshed you. Don't wait any longer. Your skin will thank you. That's lumenskin.com/Wondery for your free trial.
The morning of September 11th, my wife and I actually had gone to her obstetrician. That morning, I actually went into work late because I had to go with her to her obstetrician because we were trying to get pregnant. I was in the waiting room filling out some forms, and on the television screen was an image of the Twin Towers, and there was a fire. And someone said that a plane had hit one of the towers, and most people assumed that it was like a small plane. And so I was looking at it, and I didn't really make that much of it. We did our appointment, and then I got into a taxi cab to go down to Bellevue, where I was, you know, working for the week. And in the taxi on the way down, we were on the FDR Drive. It came on the radio that a second plane had hit the other tower. And I remember thinking, like, what are the chances of that happening? Like, how bizarre. But honestly, even at that point, I didn't think it was a deliberate act, because it was something just out of, you know, my, and I think most people's conception, that people could actually do this and do a suicide crash into a building. So I got to the hospital, and then it very quickly became clear that this had been a deliberate act and that we should expect casualties at Bellevue, because Bellevue is one of the level one trauma centers in New York and did serve that part of the city. We were told to empty the medical intensive care units, the cardiac care units. When we were clearing out the cardiac care unit, someone said, "Oh my God, the tower just came down." And I remember thinking, wow, this person must be really stressed because they're hallucinating. And I remember going over to the window and looking out and seeing only one building and just a massive amount of smoke. That's kind of lent urgency to what we were doing. And then at that point, we were told to discharge any patients who didn't need to be in the hospital and that we should report for duty down in the emergency room. So I remember when I went down to the emergency room, there were all these surgeons just waiting in the emergency room for casualties to come in. And I do remember two episodes in that time I was down there. One was that a cop was brought in, and it appeared he was having chest pain. It appeared he had suffered a heart attack. He wasn't injured physically by the falling debris or whatever, but he had been down there when the tower collapsed. And I remember asking him, you know, something like, you know, how are you doing? And he said, "Doctor, the things I've seen today," and then he just couldn't continue. He just started sobbing. The other thing I remember, apparently a firefighter had died, and a social worker took the wife of the deceased firefighter into a separate room to break the bad news. And I just remember the wife just screaming in disbelief. But I do remember all these surgeons standing around waiting for all this sort of onslaught of casualties, and very few patients were being brought in. And so around mid-afternoon, I went out to the parking lot, and there was an ambulance that was getting ready to go down to Ground Zero. And they were looking for volunteers to go down, and so I volunteered. Drove down, they let us off a few hundred yards from where the buildings had collapsed. We were supposed to be working at a makeshift triage type center, and when I got there, the elevators were stopped, and inside the elevators were medical supplies. The place had been turned into several different departments, you know, trauma and injuries, wounds and fractures, and I went to asthma and chest pain. There weren't that many patients who were in really any department. There were a few firefighters wheezing from, you know, all the smoke, but otherwise there were just very few patients. And I remember at one point just blurting out, "Where are all the patients?" And someone said, "They're all dead." You know, at that point, it just really hit me, the magnitude of the disaster. We were there for probably about an hour and a half. And then at some point, we had to leave the building because another building, and I believe this was the World Trade Center 7 building, was on fire. And they couldn't put out the fire, and there was a fear that it was going to collapse also. We got like these stretchers, and we put all these supplies on stretchers, and we kind of lifted them, taking these supplies down to Pace University, and we were going to set up shop there. You know, we went outside and started basically running to Pace University, and I mean, it was a disaster zone. It's hard to fathom what had happened. You know, I remember thinking, this isn't New York City, this is Beirut. Bombed out cars, you know, windshields covered in thick ash. Water mains were broken, and there was like water running and mixing with all the ash and turning into mud. You know, up at Bellevue, it was still sunny. You know, it was a sunny day. Down at Ground Zero, where we were, it was like nighttime. Like a heavy dusk. So we ended up going to Pace University and setting up shop there. I stayed for a little while, and then the building that had been burning came down. I just remember getting blanketed by smoke. We were probably, I don't know, maybe two blocks away, but the smoke just hit. At that point, I had been in touch with my wife by cell phone. You know, she was like, "I don't feel comfortable with you being down there. You need to come home." So I hitched a ride with a police officer covered in soot and ash. And so I got home probably around 9 o'clock, you know, saw my wife, and we just kind of spent the evening together watching the news, seeing what had happened and trying to process it all. The morning of September 12th, I was planning on going to work. I called one of my co-fellows, and he said that no one was in the department and that some of the doctors had gone down to the World Trade Center site to work in a unit there. And so I was in my neighborhood and I saw a cop car and I said, I work at Bellevue and a lot of my colleagues are down at Ground Zero. And he said, you would take me. I eventually made my way to this MASH unit that had been set up in a firehouse. I could see the twin towers. I could see the base. Sort of the bowels of the buildings were unleashed from the buildings. I mean, there was like all these broken wires and pipes. The street was muddy. There were police dogs sniffing around the rubble. There was like a line of people sort of removing pieces of rock. At some point, someone yelled that they needed doctors in the Brooks Brothers building. I wasn't sure why they were asking, but I volunteered to go with this policeman. We went into the lobby and there were German shepherds and there was a lot of broken glass and there were cops and there was a dark curtain. The cops who had brought me started to take me in behind the curtain and someone said, only doctors are allowed back there. And he explained that I was a doctor. And so I went in. I remember there were maybe three doctors, a couple of medical students, and a nurse. The medical students and the nurse were sitting behind a table. They had tags with them. They were sort of filling out paperwork or getting directions from these doctors. And then I joined that group. They were talking about processing body parts. Turned out this was like a morgue that had been set up. And they were talking about the protocol for what to do when body parts came in. None of them really knew what they were doing. None of us knew what we were doing. People were just sort of asking questions like, are you supposed to put body parts into one bag or put them into separate bags because they could be body parts from different people? And no one really knew. The nurse and the two medical students were sitting behind this table and they're just sort of waiting for instructions. At some point, maybe a few minutes after I arrived, they brought in part of a human being. It was the lower part of someone's body. The whole torso had been severed from the rest of their body, and all they had was like a pelvis and one leg just attached. And out of this pelvis were like intestines that had broken, that had been severed. When that portion of torso was brought in, the female doctor who was there said, "Oh, Mother of God." And we looked, and it was so gruesome, so horrific. The person had been wearing jeans. And the piece of the body that had been brought in, the leg was covered by like a torn portion of jean, of blue jean. And so they emptied the pocket and there was change in it. And they put that in a separate kind of plastic bag. And then someone said that this was the other portion of the body that had been brought in a little bit earlier, I guess before I had arrived. And that portion of that of the body had a cell phone. So they had the cell phone. So they, put this portion of torso and leg into a body bag. And, at that point, the older doctor said that, like, he had to take a break. His badge said PGY3, which meant he was a third-year resident. I was a PGY4 at the time because I had finished my residency and now I was a cardiology fellow. So it just hit me that of all the doctors in the room, I had the most experience. I was actually the most senior doctor. And that just made me feel incredibly uncomfortable because I had absolutely no clue what to do in that situation. I had always felt very queasy in medical school, in the anatomy lab, dissecting cadavers. I had never been really interested in pathology, and it wasn't what I went into medicine for. And suddenly I developed this almost panic that they were going to ask me to like run the show, which is basically what they did. This doctor said, I have to leave. Apparently he'd been there for a few hours. And the female doctor also said that she had to get away. And she looked at me and she said, are you a doctor? And I said, yes. And she said, great, you can take over. That was it. And they both left. And I think there was just me and one other. It's all very vague. I don't quite even remember if there was another physician with me. I think there was. And then there were the two medical students and the nurse. We were just, you know, just there. A few minutes later, they brought in more body parts, and this, it was hard to tell what it was, what the parts were. There was like, it looked like it was maybe a liver, part of a spleen. So I was like, I think this is a spleen. I think this is a liver. These med students and this nurse were just writing that down, and then they were putting those parts into a body bag. They were bringing in portions of bodies, and it wasn't clear whether these basically disembodied organs, whether they were from one person, from several people, and it wasn't clear whether we should put them all together or we should put them separately. There were piles and piles of unused body bags in the dressing room. And, you know, looking around the store, as we're doing this work, there were all these like headless mannequins that they had used to, you know, model their clothing. And there were piles and piles of neatly folded Brooks Brothers shirts in different colors. I just remember the colors so well. They were muted because there was a lot of ash and dust, but you could still make out that there were blue shirts and pink shirts and yellow shirts and white shirts. And then there were all these unused yellow body bags. The surrealism of the experience just, it was hard to fathom. Like, I thought I was in a movie. This had to be some sort of setup. We were in a men's clothing emporium. I mean, I'd worn Brooks Brothers clothes in residency, you know, when I wanted to dress up. And here we were, you know, in a clothing store, being asked to do these sort of impossible thing. I remember thinking that, you know, I had just finished my residency. In my third year of residency, a lot of my friends had done international electives. They had gone to impoverished areas of Asia to work in public health and infectious disease. And they would talk about how difficult it was to work in areas with so few resources. But we had plenty of resources. It was just, it was netherworld medicine. We were in some sort of like conception of Dante's Inferno. It was just unbelievable. In that situation, as you can imagine, book knowledge is totally useless. You could never simulate in a medical school or residency training exercise what we were faced with. So it was all about improvising, but you're improvising with the background of such monumental tragedy that it makes you feel really uncomfortable. Just even a simple thing like, do we put all the body parts into one bag or separate bags? I remember thinking, you know, if you put them in separate bags, what if they end up getting separated? That didn't seem right. But putting the remains of several victims together in a bag just seemed wrong. And it's like, how do you identify? How do you figure this out? It seemed at the moment incredibly important that we like do the right thing, we figure this out. And then to still have to do it and have to do it rather quickly with people watching, it was so hard. And I'm not surprised that the other two doctors just, they left. They had to leave. They couldn't do it. And after a while, I don't remember how long, I just started to feel physically ill. I just couldn't be there anymore. And I said that I was going to have to leave, which I did. left and went out the sort of back entrance and went back to the MASH unit where I had initially been at the firehouse. The whole experience like kind of wilted me. And I wasn't a stranger to emergencies, right? I mean, in cardiology, we dealt with emergencies all the time. Patients go into cardiogenic shock, go into acute heart failure, go into life-threatening arrhythmia, having a heart attack. So I was used to dealing with emergencies, but this seemed of a different scale. You know, it seems kind of trivial, but my wife was very upset that I was down there. She kept saying that she really wanted me to get out of there, that if I wasn't going to be in the hospital, then I needed to be at home with her. You know, all along, we'd been trying to get pregnant, and we were actually pursuing in vitro fertilization. And so at the end of the day, you know, when I was getting ready to leave, I said, I'm coming home now. And she said, fine, can you just stop by the Apthorpe pharmacy and pick up our IVF materials? And I remember thinking like, oh my God, like, no, I can't do that. So like, you know, life was still going on. Like we still had plans to, you know, have a baby. So that didn't stop. But she had no idea of what I had gone through that day. Eventually, it's probably like, I don't know, but the next day, if I remember correctly, we went back to the hospital and we just went back to our training routine. You know, I believe I was in the echocardiography lab and was learning how to read echocardiograms and how to scan patients and went back to taking call. In the midst of all that, bodies were removed from the rubble and they were processed in these sort of mobile morgues that were parked just off First Avenue between Bellevue and Tisch Hospital. And so you could kind of smell that work. In between my work at Bellevue and then we'd have lunch conference at Tisch, I'd have to run in between the two hospitals and pass these trucks and smell the decaying bodies. It was very stark.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
So much of my life in my first couple of years after 9/11 was spent in the hospital, taking care of patients, you know, in a very busy training program. Like I said earlier, life goes on. Your married life goes on. The kinds of things that you're planning to do goes on. Your professional development, specifically, like, we still had to make a baby. You know, I still had to do my training. And then longer term, worries came up about my exposure to, you know, all the dust and all the dangerous chemicals that I had been exposed to. I think for a portion of this, the time I was down there, I don't even remember having a mask. For a while, I developed what I thought were pulmonary problems I had never had in my whole life, like asthma. And so all these things are going on, right? But no one can really see what you've suffered in your heart. No one can erase those images. And so you have to continue to function with this almost terrible secret. Like, you can talk about it, but no one can really appreciate it. So I remember those months afterwards just resenting these things I had to do. Like, there was no time to like recoup, you know, recover, rehabilitate. And, you know, I was relatively newly married too. So there was that whole thing to negotiate, you know. I mean, it was a wonderful time, don't get me wrong, but at the same time, it was a stressful time. there's kind of like your feet are in these concrete boots. Like you don't want to get up sometimes in the morning, you know, to like do what you have to do. You have nightmares, you know, like I had this recurring nightmare that I was actually in the building and I was plummeting down the various floors that were collapsing, and I was collapsing. I was going down. I couldn't stop having that. I mean, that eventually, fortunately, stopped, but I had it for quite some time. And so the hardest part was continuing to live your life and kind of continue to follow the script that had been laid out for yourself, by yourself, and then feeling like everything had changed. But not everyone could really understand why it had changed or how it had changed. Yes, they knew you were down there. They knew you'd seen some very terrible things, but they'd never really understand it because they weren't there. I successfully finished my training, became a cardiologist, wrote the books I wanted to write. I did those things. Maybe I had a little guilt afterwards. I was still able to do those things, and so many people had perished. But I still never really talked about 9/11. I didn't want to talk about it. When 9/11 came around, I never posted anything on social media. I kind of ignored it for years, years and years and years. After the 9/11 memorial, I never went. Eventually I went, I took my kids. It sent shivers up my spine, you know. The way they did it was, I think, really incredible. Incredible how that the water flows into that sort of bottomless pit. It really, really just floored me. I think it really encapsulated how I felt. The water was flowing down into this cavern that seems bottomless, like it's actually leading into hell. That was the experience for me at that Brooks Brothers morgue, that I had kind of entered a sort of hell. That was very powerful to me. There was a young woman who survived, who was removed from the rubble with a crushed leg, but nothing else. She was admitted to Bellevue, and she was being seen by the arrhythmia service. And I remember hearing about her at conferences that she had developed these arrhythmias that were very difficult to manage. It was very clear to me even then, and even more so now as a cardiologist, that the stress and the trauma of what she had gone through was almost certainly precipitating these incessant and essentially life-threatening arrhythmias. So this was something that caused me to revisit that experience down at Ground Zero those 2 days, really for weeks afterward, because we'd talk about this patient or we'd talk about other people who had been retrieved and had survived. So, you know, I've always been fascinated by the heart, both as a biomechanical pump, which is how modern medicine conceives of the heart, but also by the cultural and metaphorical meanings of the heart, especially the emotional meanings, something that has engaged the cultural imagination for millennia, really. The heart, it's like the only organ in the body that sort of palpably moves, that you can feel moving. The heart has been thought throughout history as the container, the vessel of human emotions. Bravery, fear, love are all thought to be contained within the heart. And when I heard about this patient, you know, who had survived and had developed these incessant arrhythmias, it just drove home to me the point that the emotions have a profound effect, you know, on the heart and on heart rhythms and so on. And that led me to think more deeply about the heart as not just a mechanical pump, but as an emotional canvas. How important the emotions are in leading to cardiac pathology, both in an acute sense, like in this young woman who developed these life-threatening arrhythmias, but also in a chronic sense, how emotional stress over long periods of time can lead to worsening heart disease. You know, through the course of my training, I came across kind of the paradigm of this sort of emotional heart intersecting with the biological heart. The sort of archetype of this paradigm is the broken heart syndrome, where, you know, patients who suffer severe emotional upset, like from the breakup of a relationship or the death of a loved one, can actually have physical effects, can suffer physical effects on the heart. The heart can actually acutely change shape. I mean, just to give you one small example, I mean, the patients we had who had defibrillators, they were getting shocked more and more after 9/11, probably because of post-traumatic stress. And that was just striking to me. You know, the Greeks were onto something. The ancient philosophers were onto something. It was clear that there was an overlap between this emotional object that the Greeks thought was sort of this purely metaphorical object, or at least the way we conceive it today as a purely metaphorical object, the heart as the container, the vessel of human emotions, and this biomechanical pump, the concept of which evolved from 18th, 19th, 20th centuries, to the point where we started to think of the heart as being just a entity that had pipes that got clogged and had wires that sometimes crossed and caused arrhythmias. And we sort of conceptualized the heart as this purely mechanical object. But it was so clear to me that it's both, and these two types of hearts overlap. And so I would say that this experience led me as a cardiologist to think more deeply about the effects of the emotions on the heart. And it was an uphill struggle because, you know, throughout my entire fellowship, no one really talked about the emotions. You know, that just seemed like a fuzzy concept. We talked about the resistance of coronary arteries. We talked about the capacitance of cardiac chambers. We talked about all these sort of physics concepts that I was very familiar with and comfortable with, but no one really talked about, you know, how emotional stress can affect heart health. You know, even today, the American Heart Association doesn't recognize emotional stress as a key modifiable risk factor for heart disease. They're coming around to it, but they still don't officially recognize it like they do cholesterol or high blood pressure or so on. Part of that is because we can lower cholesterol and we can lower blood pressure with medications. It's much harder to treat emotional disruption, emotional stress, like what happened on the scale, you know, of, you know, or what happened on 9/11. So I think that experience really had lingering effects on my career. It eventually motivated me to, you know, write my last book, which is Heart of History, which really explored this theme, you know, much more deeply. Anyone who lived in New York City during those weeks and months after 9/11 remembers how the city came together. I remember outside Bellevue, there were all these posters of, you know, people who were missing, and it was just heart-wrenching. People lent a helping hand. You know, even in the hospital, I feel like things changed for some time. You know, people were just a little gentler, a little nicer, a sense of we're all in this together. And for me, the long-term change was that, you know, I pivoted from wanting to do kind of hardcore cardiology, you know, the way that my professors had done it, the way that some of my co-fellows were doing it, into a sort of a more human-based cardiology, which is sort of in keeping with why I went into medicine in the first place, because I really wanted to make a difference in people's lives. And so pretty soon after 9/11, I decided to specialize in congestive heart failure, which I believe is the most humanistic of all the cardiology disciplines. You know, it's not purely imaging like cardiac ultrasound. It's not just doing procedures like putting in stents. It's looking at the whole person, a person who has a rhythm, who might need a stent, who needs imaging, but is also a real person who's suffering with a incurable disease. And I just realized that that's the kind of cardiologist I wanted to be. The average amount of time that a doctor gives to a patient to speak freely, uninterrupted, is about 16 seconds. That's not enough time, because so much of what's ailing the patient isn't necessarily the chest pain, but it's like what's going on in their lives. I don't know if I would have been a different doctor if I hadn't gone through this, but I do believe that the experience and the path that it led me down, those paths made me a better doctor. The experience of 9/11 and all the sort of emotional overtones, all the sort of emotional repercussions in the months afterwards, it's hard not to think about the finiteness of life when you're as young as I was when, or at least how I remember how young I was, and you're in a morgue, in a clothing store, processing body parts on a day that you thought you'd be doing something completely different. It's hard for that not to have a profound effect.
Today's episode featured Sandeep Johar. Sandeep has written 3 books, including his latest book, Heart, A History, which tells the colorful and little-known history of the doctors who risked their careers and the patients who risked their lives to know and heal our most vital organ. A practicing cardiologist, Johar is currently a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, has been published in the Wall Street Journal, Time, and Slate, and has appeared on NPR, CNN, and MSNBC to discuss issues related to medicine. To learn more about him and his work, visit the website sandeepjohar.com or follow him on Twitter at sjohar. That's S-J-A-U-H-A-R. From Wondery, you're listening to This Is Actually Happening. With our special series honoring the 20th anniversary of 9/11, The Long Shadow. If you love what we do, please rate and review the show. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. You can also join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free. In the episode notes, you'll find some links and offers from our sponsors. By supporting them, you help us bring you our shows for free. I'm your host, Whit Misseldine. Today's episode was co-produced by me.
A special thanks to all who helped out with this series to make it happen. Ellen Westberg, Andrew Waits, Marcelino Vialpando, Gabriella Quintana, Emily Caldwell, and Jason Blaylock.
The intro music features the song Illabai by Tipper. You can join the This Is Actually Happening community on the discussion group on Facebook or at Actually Happening on Instagram.
On the show's website, thisisactuallyhappening.com, you can find out more about the podcast, contact us with any questions, submit your own story, or visit the store, where you can find This Is Actually Happening designs on stickers, t-shirts, wall art, hoodies, and more. That's thisisactuallyhappening.com. And finally, if you'd like to become an ongoing supporter of what we do, go to patreon.com/happening. Even $2 to $5 a month goes a long way to support our vision. Thank you for listening.
Hey Prime members, you can listen to This Is Actually Happening ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loreau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.